This episode is brought to you by Jane Austen. Okay, that's not actually true. This episode is brought to you by Writing with Jane Austen, a new six-week online creative writing course taught by me, Jonathan Rogers. Starting April 6th, we will read through Pride and Prejudice together. Then we'll examine how Jane Austen works her particular kind of magic, and then we'll apply those principles to our own writing. You can find out more at thehabit.co/Jane. Welcome to The Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host.
O Holy Spirit, meet, fill, and quicken now these insufficient gifts. Inspire prayers that would shepherd and comfort your people, even in their dyings, even in their griefs. Voicing their mortal laments and their eternal hopes, gently turning their gaze to the promise of coming resurrection, to the hope of a world remade, and to the splendor of the King who soon returns to redeem all sorrows. Amen.
That was Doug McKelvey reading from his liturgy, Begging the Grace to Accomplish What is Beyond Me. It's part of the invocation, and an incredibly appropriate one for his new book, Every Moment Holy 2, Death, Grief, and Hope. It's a book of liturgies for seasons of dying and grieving. Who wouldn't feel that such a task is beyond him? But Doug took on this important work with grace and humility and a commitment to the readers that the work would serve. It was my privilege to sit down with him and to talk about it. Doug McKelvey, thank you for being on the Habit Podcast today.
I'm happy to be here.
So the second volume of Every Moment Holy has just released, or is releasing, or something along those lines. Volume 2, Death, Grief, and Hope. You know, I got an email the other day from somebody who knew I knew you, and they were like, I've been reading this Every Moment Holy 2, and how does, like, has Doug McKelvey experienced all these things? How did he know how to write about all these different situations? And I told them I didn't know. So now it's your chance to answer that question, Doug.
Well, it's probably a two-part answer, because the second part is what you just asked. How did I know what to write? The first part would probably be, why did I decide to do a book on this subject matter anyway? Mm-hmm. And the answer to both is kind of along the same continuum. When Volume 1 came out, I knew that the biggest gaping hole in it topically was that I hadn't written a prayer for people who were experiencing grief, kind of that first season of reeling from losing someone. That topic had been on the list of potential prayers to write for Volume 1, but as I was headed toward the print deadline, there were a lot of topics I knew I wasn't going to get to. And I think I just didn't have the emotional bandwidth to try to start from scratch on that one, because I knew it was going to be a weighty one. And and I was just pinched for time. And, you know, there were probably 100 or more topics on the list that I didn't get to.
Yeah.
And that was just one of them. But I knew at some point this needs to be addressed. I want to offer people who are in that season of sorrow a prayer that might help to articulate what's on their hearts, and might in some way help to serve them and shepherd them through that. So it was probably a year after Volume 1 released that I finally sat down and said, okay, I'm going to try to write that prayer.
Yeah. Wait, I'm sorry, just real quick. There's not even one prayer?
There's one for the anniversary of a loss.
Uh-huh.
There's one for the loss of a pet in Volume 1. But really, that's as close as it gets. I mean, there are some others that I think people have used parts of. And, you know, like maybe the death of a dream, or you know, that where they found some language that echoed something that they were experiencing in relation to losing someone, but there was nothing specifically for that. And in fact, Pete Peterson, the editor at Rabbit Room Press during the year of build-up to Volume 1 being released, had been telling people whenever he would talk about what subjects would be addressed, and you know, he would give three or four examples. One of them was always a liturgy for the morning of a funeral. So there was pressure there.
You're
but
right.
I buckled under the pressure, I guess. So a year after Volume 1 came out, we didn't know if there would be a Volume 2. There mm-hmm. there was nothing definite. But I thought, okay, we have the website, everymomentholy.com, where we have PDF downloads of prayers, and if I write this prayer, we could at least put it up there, make it one of the free ones, so that it's there for people who could benefit from it. And then if there ever is a Volume 2, it could go in that. So I started working on a liturgy for those who grieve. And within a week and a half of working on it, it had expanded to 8 or 10 pages, which I knew from the process of figuring out how to, you know, how what my workflow would be on writing and editing for Volume 1. I realized, okay, this is unwieldy, it's not working, so that probably means either I have extraneous stuff in here or I'm trying to just cover too much ground. And,
right.
And so I looked at it from that perspective and realized, okay, there are actually 5 or 6 different topics that I'm trying to address here, and I really need to limit it to 1 or at most 2. But I couldn't see anything that I could cut, I could just lose, because it was like, well, each of these things are essential. So I split it into 5 or 6 different prayers at that point and continued to work on each of those. And they continued to expand and fractalize. And so I went back to Rabbit Room Press and I said, I think this is, maybe it's a little book of its own, topically focused, so it'll be shorter than Volume 1. Yeah. But, you know, a book related to grief, and maybe it's 30, 35 prayers, so about a third the length of the first book. And they said, yeah, that's great. Let's move toward that. But it just kept expanding, and I just began to realize there are so many facets to grief and so many different kinds of loss. I mean, it's a very different thing for someone to lose an elderly parent than it is for someone to lose a young child. It's a different thing to lose someone to a long illness than it is to lose someone in a tragic accident suddenly. And then there's the whole aspect of dying. What about prayers that might serve the person who gets the prognosis that they just have a few months to live and has to navigate that whole season of moving toward the end of their life? And what does it mean as a follower of Jesus to walk through the valley of the shadow? And then what about caregivers? They could use some prayers. And what about those who are trying to minister to those who are grieving, those who are going to mourn with those who mourn? So it wasn't long before I realized, okay, this is actually going to be, you know, a book. Probably it should just be Volume 2 of Every Moment Holy, because it's going to be that long. And Volume 1 took about a year to write. Volume 2 took 2 years and actually ended up being, I think, 79 pages longer than Volume 1. So that's the answer to the first part of the question of why.
It wasn't my question. It was you.
right. Yes.
Yeah. I only asked you one question.
Yeah, so we'll get to your question now. So as I started to get deeper into trying to write these prayers, I realized very quickly that, well, I was struggling with a sense of presumption.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And some fear and trembling in approaching some of these subjects, because I was thinking, and very rightly so, what business do I have writing about the loss of a child?
Yeah.
When I have not experienced that? How could I know? How could I articulate what someone experiencing that is actually going through? And I knew that the only way I could end up with prayers that would actually speak to the hearts and speak words that could come from the hearts of people in these different kinds of situations related to grief or to dying would be if people who were in those situations, who were on those journeys, were weighing in.
Yeah.
That I was in conversation with them as I was writing these prayers and giving them, you know, the power to say when it was ready, mm-hmm. when it was finished.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And letting them, you know, challenge me on, uh-huh. on parts of it and say, this part is working, this part, you know, you're completely missing it. This would actually be unhelpful and potentially hurtful to people in this situation.
Can you give a specific instance of a place where you were being unhelpful? Can you think of one?
Yeah. On the liturgy for grieving well a loss from suicide.
Uh-huh.
There was someone who had lost their brother, who really gave me good feedback on that one and helped me dial it in over a period of months.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, a lot of these took lots of iterations and editing and re-editing and changing nuances. And that one, it was, you know, I had, well, here's what had happened. I had been contacted by someone I didn't know who had heard that I was writing a volume 2, mm-hmm. you know, on the subject of grief. She was a woman who had lost her husband to suicide.
Uh-huh.
And there had just been like a high profile suicide of a pastor. And at the memorial service, his widow had contextualized his suicide in terms of that God needed him more, you know, in heaven,
uh-huh.
something. And she was just admonishing me proactively, yeah. to say, if you're going to have a prayer about suicide, you know, do not go that kind of direction, which I wasn't going that direction. But she also said, he has left me and my kids with so much anger, uh-huh. to deal with. We feel so abandoned by him. And at every stage of their lives, they're going to have to deal with this again, you know, with, yeah. his absence from their high school graduation and from their wedding. And it's like, this isn't going to go away.
Yeah.
And so I had had correspondence with this woman before I wrote the first draft of this prayer. And so I had included a good bit of language about the anger.
Uh-huh.
Right. But then when I asked my friend who had lost her 13-year-old brother to suicide to read it, she said, if my mom read this, she would stop right at that point. Because it's like, we might have had some anger issues to deal with, but that wasn't our dominant emotion. Mm-hmm. And though we might have some anger that we've had to work through in relation to the choice he made, we aren't going to tolerate someone else expressing anger about it, that we're going to be defensive about that. And so I really had to wrestle with that. And what I then realized was, I think this has to be two different prayers, because the way people respond to suicide in their family probably has a lot to do with whether the person who has made that choice is someone that they depended on.
Right.
Right? A spouse that you're in partnership with and you're depending on them, or a parent, you know, who's supposed to be there for you and help guide you through your life and provide for you, that there's a sense of abandonment and of someone abdicating their responsibility that they were supposed to lovingly steward, you know, in relation to you, that there is this overriding response of anger that someone in that situation typically feels, that someone who loses a child or a sibling doesn't have that same experience. So
it's probably an insight you didn't have access to.
Yes, exactly. Very much so. I mean, I don't think I would have reached that understanding on my own.
Yeah.
So at that point, I did split it into two prayers, where there's the liturgy for one who feels abandoned by one who chose suicide, and then the liturgy for grieving well, you know, a loss due to suicide. So yeah, that one's one that really stood out, because I had written the first draft based on what I gained from my correspondence with the woman who had lost her husband to suicide. And then someone else had contacted me saying, hey, the pastor of my church committed suicide this week. We're all reeling. I heard that you're writing this book. Do you have anything that would be appropriate, you know, for a prayer for us to use as we're trying to work through this? And so I almost sent that draft, because I was, a lot of people were approaching me about different, you know, different losses that they were experiencing and asking if I had anything I could go ahead and send them, you know, a year before the book came out. And so there were a lot of prayers I had sent out to people, and I almost hit send on that one. But then I thought, I want to get feedback from my friend who had lost her brother first. So that's when I sent it to her, and she responded and said, I don't have time to give you a long explanation right now, but no, do not send this.
Wow.
You know, which was hard to, you know, because it's like, I've worked so long on these. I wanted it to be right. But I was so grateful to her at the same time that she was willing to be that honest and just say, no, this is not ready. This could actually be emotionally hurtful to someone, and don't send it. Yeah. So,
you know, you've been talking, or you've already mentioned this idea that you are helping people to articulate, you know, their feelings, their beliefs, their, you know, whatever, or you're giving people words to, you know, put into words what's going on inside them. But it occurs to me also at the same time, which, and by the way, I think that's, you know, all writers, you know, including and especially country songwriters, for instance, are sort of giving people words for things that they feel but don't know how to put words to. I think it's one of the great services that a writer does to other people.
Sure.
But you're also, you know, in a situation, you're describing situations where you're assuming a huge responsibility for giving people words to express something that you don't fully understand necessarily. And I guess you're also inviting them to, here's a starting place for some words you can put to what's going on inside you. But it's still kind of up to the audience in some ways to to finish putting those into words, because you can't do all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true, that there's an aspect of this book in particular that I hope that people don't come to it with the expectation that it is going to be capable of doing everything for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope that it will, in specific situations, that it will give words
right.
when words are impossible to reach otherwise, because yeah. someone is just reeling, they're in shock, they're...
Yeah.
They're feeling too much the weight of strong emotion, but yeah, I don't have a sense that, you know, that this is going to do all of the, it's not going to replace, you know, those moments where the person is just pouring out in prayer or in conversation
yeah.
with a friend the depths of what is in their heart and those things that are specific and peculiar to their own
sure.
grief.
Yeah.
But I do hope that it can open up some of those spaces.
I think that's exactly what these... I mean, just remember from Volume 1, it's been so fun to see how many people, you know, from Volume 1 have then gone and written their own liturgy for something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it feels... What you're doing in these two books feels like you really are opening something up for people and giving them a starting place. I think that's one of the things that excites me so much about what you're doing in these both of these books. Have you finished answering the question, the only question I've asked so far?
What was that question again?
The question was, how do you know what to...
Okay, so yeah, I mean,
I kind of interrupted you in the middle of your answer. So.
Right, so one big part of that was community.
Mm-hmm.
That I was in conversation with a lot of people. I mean, I think there were probably more than 150 email conversations.
Really?
I mean, some of them just a shorter exchange. Some
uh-huh.
of them that went on longer. But with people, most of whom had reached out to me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, at a certain point, maybe 6 months into the writing process, I had made a social media post saying, hey, I've written this prayer, and I forget which one it was, but it was one related to those early
mm-hmm.
Days of grieving. Or no, it might have been one for the hardship of holidays,
uh-huh.
of navigating. You know, it was close to Thanksgiving, Christmas season coming up. And so... You know, it wasn't even there were probably two or three more drafts that I ended up doing on that one eventually before it made its way into the book. But I just wanted to offer that to people, and also to be able to get feedback
mm-hmm.
from people as to whether it was, expressing what they were feeling. And I think I had over 100 responses to that within a
wow.
2 or 3 day period.
Yeah.
And most of those people, they weren't just saying, can I have this? They were telling me their story.
Yeah.
And why they wanted it. And, it would be that I lost my mom 2 years ago at Christmas, or, my son died from a high school football game injury
huh.
a week ago.
Wow.
And so, we're just navigating that and about to enter the holiday season. And with each one of them, I didn't want to just, send them a generic response
mm-hmm.
and attach the prayer to it. I really wanted to honor their grief and their specific griefs, and, you know, to interact with them and to, you know, to respond specifically to what they had told me. And so it ended up taking me days to work, you know, just, just responding to those one after another. But that's really where I began to realize, I think, how important community was going to be in this process.
Yeah.
Because I was learning things just from hearing their stories and having those interactions with them. And then there were a handful of people that I walked with through the process for much longer. There was a woman, Amy, who had just lost her husband and her 9 and 7 year old daughters in a fire on their farm. And we had a mutual acquaintance. I mean, for me, they were just someone I had met on a songwriting retreat a decade ago. For Amy, I think they're good friends of hers, but the mutual acquaintance had contacted me and told me, hey, our friends just, you know, had this tragedy, and Every Moment Holy Volume 1 has meant a lot to their family. We heard you were working on this new book of prayers about death and grief. We're going to have the memorial service in a few days. Do you have anything that you could send us, and, you know, that might be fitting for that? So I'd sent them a couple things, and they had used one of those at the memorial service. And so then about a week later, Amy, the one who had lost her husband and daughters, reached out to me through email, just sending me a thank you for that. And that began an extensive correspondence that lasted more than a year. I mean, through the second half of the process of writing the book. And Amy just was so gracious and willing to basically just say, I will give you an open window to my process. And so, you know, pretty much every week she would be, sometimes multiple times in a week, but she would send me an email just saying, here's what happened this week. Here's what I'm going through. Here's, you know, I thought I was doing good in relation to this sort of thing. And then suddenly this week it hit me. And so she weighed in, and her insights and feedback shaped so many of the prayers.
Hey, can I ask one question about that?
Yeah.
How do you get from the specifics of Amy's story to something that's more broadly applicable? Do you stay with the specifics in the trust that specifics are the universal, or do you, you know, like, can you talk about that a minute?
Well, I was also reading a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were, you know, more, I guess, academic sort of approaches to the process of grief. But the ones that were the most helpful to me were books like Lament for a Son,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
where they were just personal stories of people, you know, doing that same thing, giving a window into their own process of loss and grief. And so I think there were a lot of, and I was taking notes from those things. And, you know, when, there were a lot of topics and themes that just seemed to be so universal,
yeah,
in relation to the experience of grief and loss, that those were easy to craft prayers, yeah, based off of, because it seemed like most people experience those, yeah, those elements, mm-hmm, as part of their grief. Then there were ones that would never have occurred to me, but because of the conversations I was having, like Amy at a certain point, toward the end of the process of writing the book, told me, you know, I'm still wearing my wedding ring, but I know I'm going to want to take it off soon. I think I'm ready to do that. And I would love to have a liturgy to mark that moment. Those kind of insights into what a person walking through grief might need, you know, I didn't have personal access to.
That's funny. When I saw that liturgy, I thought, I wonder how Doug knew to do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have on my own. So again, it, you know, without so much input from community, it just the book could not have been couldn't have served grieving people in the way that I think it will now because there were so many grieving people who weighed in and helped to shape it, you know, based on what they need.
You said you spent 2 years writing these prayers and liturgies.
Yes.
What did those 2 years take out of you, or what did they cost you?
I don't think I can completely answer that yet. I mean, I know there was a gravity to those 2 years, and a lot of that was having this heightened ongoing awareness of how many people around me are grieving at a given moment that, you know, I know I don't typically navigate through my day looking at everyone around me and thinking, oh, I wonder what they're carrying. You know, some of these people have probably just recently lost someone or are walking through the season of life where they know that they're losing someone, or they're involved in taking care of an elderly parent who's in decline, or, you know, or they, you know, they're 40 years old now, but when they were 6 years old, they lost their dad. And, you know, have I really considered what it means for them to have carried that kind of early loss through their life? Yeah. And, you know, am I living with the awareness of all these burdens that other people are carrying? Well, because I was interacting so much with people in these seasons of life, there was a weight to that, but it's not, you know, it's not this impossible burden that just makes life dark and clouds out any hope. You know, in Scripture, we're told to rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. And there is a cost to doing that.
Yeah.
Right? And it's right that there should be. It's not like this is an imbalanced sense of burden.
Yeah.
So I think that heightened sense of how much sorrow there is in the lives of people around me that they're carrying and navigating led to just this greater sense of gravity and longing, you know, for what's to come, for these things to be made right. And whereas with volume one, it was a difficult season of writing, the year that I spent writing it. not just the writing itself and some of the topics of doubt and disappointment and failure and those things that were really pushing my own buttons.
Yeah, because
because that's very much, I mean, those were my fears.
Yeah.
Even in that season, those were,
yeah,
those were my personal fears. But just, it was everything, it was like every part of my life was stressful and not working during that year. It's,
yeah,
like it just felt like the wheels were falling off. And then as soon as the writing process was done, it was like all that pressure lifted off and just sort of, you know, like a spring that had been pressed down just rebounded. And then it was like everything was fine. Life life seemed easy and great for a while. And with volume two, I didn't have that same level as I was writing of feeling like I'm stressed and everything is falling apart. I was wrestling with the writing process and can I really do this? And,
mm-hmm,
you know, struggling to pull these liturgies into place and just, you know, so aware of my own inadequacy and in relation to what I was trying to do with the book. But I wasn't experiencing just, my life didn't feel like chaos.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there was no spring back,
uh-huh,
to a more buoyant life when I finished.
Yeah.
You know, it just continued, whatever burden had kind of accrued or sense of gravity or whatever it might be, has just, it's lingered.
Yeah.
You know, it's remained. And so I feel like I haven't decompressed,
huh,
from that 2-year writing process. But I'm starting to wonder if I'm not going to.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just...
Come to terms with some gravity that...
Yeah.
That maybe you're just changed.
Yeah. I think that might be the case. That, you know, some journeys you go on and you come back different.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing.
But... Yeah. But I think I should mention, this isn't a dark book. I mean, there's a lot of hope. I mean, there's hope in the whole book, and so I thought I'd mention that just lest any listeners get the impression that this book's a downer.
Yeah, well, I think early on, we, being me and the folks at Rabbit Room Press, were referring to it as everyone holy death and grief. But that was another thing that at a certain point I told them, I think we need to add the word hope,
yeah,
to it, because, you know, volume one was all about looking at these different facets of daily life or, you know, or events that come about every year and trying to unpack those in terms of, okay, if theologically we believe that every part of our lives touches on eternity,
mm-hmm,
then if we look at these different facets of life, can we unpack what that might actually mean?
Yeah.
Like if you're changing a diaper,
yeah,
you know, how does that touch on eternity? How does that fit into the larger narrative, the bigger story that God is telling through time and history, and how does this seemingly mundane part of my own little story fit,
yeah,
into that larger story? And with volume two, it was the same kind of thing, but looking at these aspects of our own mortality, the process of dying, of navigating that final season of our own lives, of caring for others and shepherding others through that process, and of grieving,
yeah,
and grieving with one another and being a community that maybe is that should be striving to learn better how to do that for one another. I forgot the question. Was there a question?
I'm not sure. I don't remember. But okay, let me just. This is not a question. This is me commenting on. I was kind of watching from a distance. With the pandemic, we didn't see each other very much during this process, and so I was kind of at a distance. But one thing I was very aware of as you were working, writing this book, was I was very aware that in the last several months you were writing this book, it was already good enough, and that nobody was going to. I mean, just from talking to Pete and other. Just kind of the impressions I got was this book was already, nobody was going to complain that this book wasn't good enough and that you hadn't covered enough ground. And yet the seriousness with which you took your responsibility, I don't know if responsibility is the right word, but the stewardship of this process, I was amazed at the way you continued to say, yeah, but here's this other small group of people that, again, I would have never thought of, and Pete would have never thought of, and that you said they need something too, mm-hmm. I guess I'm just saying thank you for taking that so seriously and for taking your responsibility and stewarding that so well to the people, because when I see this book, and I know that, I'm 51, and over the next few decades, I'm going to be needing this book more and more. Mm-hmm. And I'm really grateful that it's here. And I, at the risk of getting, overly mushy or whatever, I just want to say thank you for the work you did here and the seriousness with which you took it, because I think it's, I was hearing somebody today say, everything you do is everything you do changes the world. Even if that's just, smiling at somebody and letting them in at traffic, it's changed the world in some way. And this feels like a book that's really, in important ways, changing the world in terms of making some important realities feel a little more real. Hmm. So thank you for doing that.
Well, I appreciate those comments. There was, I think I probably spent the first year and a half of writing this book wanting to be done with it, uh-huh. and always thinking, okay, I think I'm 2 or 3 months away from from being done with this. And it was only about 3/4 of the way into the process that I finally realized that I just had to let that go, the hope of being finished with it. And also the pressure that I was feeling because, we had to keep pushing back arrangements would have been made with the printer to start printing on a specific date. And, there were several times that I had to come back to the publisher and say, I'm not going to be able to meet this deadline. Can we push it back again? But at a certain point, what I realized was that I really just had to surrender to the process and serve the work, and that it would be done when it was done, that all I could do is that I couldn't write and shape these any faster than I was doing, that all I could do is show up every day and keep trying to make progress. And then at a certain point, it would seem done.
Yeah.
and that is eventually what happened. And, and when I thought I was actually done though, then that week there were like 3 or 4 different people who contacted me.
I heard about that.
Yeah.
Okay. We got to wrap up, but I'm going to ask you, I always end with the question, who are the writers that make you want to write? You've answered that question on previous episodes. So would you just real quickly Tell me about a few books that were most helpful to you, and a few of the books about grief and hope and lamentation. You've already mentioned The Lament for a Son by Nicholas Walterstorff. Is that, do I have that name right?
I don't know how you pronounce his last name, but yes, that's the
okay. And,
that's
and the give one. Me two
and I think
more.
That one is just so lyrically beautiful.
That's an amazing book.
I think that one impacted me more than any others.
Yeah.
Another book that that I found really helpful is by a Nashville pastor, Matthew McCullough, and it's called Remember Death.
Yeah, I know that book.
Yeah. Those were probably the two most helpful, Lament for a Son and Remember Death. There were a lot of other good ones I read. I'm just not good at recalling book titles or movies off the top of my head. So.
Well, Doug McKelvey, thank you so much for being on the Habit Podcast.
Thank you, Jonathan.
I hope everybody reads this book.
This podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. And all our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate. Special thanks as well to Taylor Linhart for letting us use her song Diamonds as the theme music for season 3 of the Habit Podcast. You can learn more about Taylor and follow her work at taylorlinhart.com.
The Habit membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.